So my guest today is Ethan Iverson. Hi, welcome to Trinity Laban, where we're doing the interview. How are you liking England then?
I've always loved England. It's one of my favorite places to tour.
Why is that?
I grew up watching the BBC and reading all the great English literature, so it always feels like coming home in some kind of way.
Oh, fantastic. You're on tour with Martin Speak, who I actually interviewed in my last show, and I just wondered how the tour was going and what's like playing here in the clubs, maybe compared to the States, or is it very similar?
It's really nice to tour here with Martin in this sort of small club circuit. There's nothing comparable in America, actually. Jazz is from America, but this kind of feeling you get here on tour in England and sometimes in, I don't know, Italy or Germany or Spain is actually really lovely, and one gets the sense that there are more jazz supporters outside of America, you know, per capita, shall we say, more jazz supporters outside of America than in America itself.
Wow. I mean, I know that I've played, obviously, a lot in the UK, but I have played in Europe. I think we've got a pretty good scene here. I mean, there's quite a lot of clubs, aren't there? They're quite close together, and they seem to be able to get a good audience. And a lot of them are run by jazz enthusiasts, aren't they?
It's amazing. I actually mentioned today already in the masterclass, England has a really phenomenal jazz history. You know, a lot of great players, not just great players, though, but people who have really made an influence in the music. People like Dave Holland, John McLaughlin, Evan Parker, Kenny Wheeler. I'm a big fan of Django Bates. He's an influence on me. I don't think I could say that about every country, you know, but England really has an incredible tradition of jazz going back to the dawn of jazz, really the 20s and 30s, and the first times Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington were coming to England.
Well, it's really nice of you to say how great a country we have here, and I'm going to move on to a successful group that you played in, formed. You can tell us a bit about it. The Bad Plus, this is my impression, the Bad Plus was an incredibly successful group. I saw 14 albums listed. It's a piano trio, yourself on piano, Reed Anderson bass, David King was on drums, and I thought, for me I'm a musician, but as a listener, I thought the whole band was equally important. I thought each instrument had a strong identity, and the composition showed off, to my mind, the personalities of the band. And your second album, I think I was talking about this earlier, These Are the Vistas, is the one I'm more familiar with. And my favourites are Big Eater and 1972 Medalist, as well as having some influence from rock grooves and obviously jazz. You managed to create humour with some of the improvisations. And I put it here as just going a little bit over the top. Excessive chromaticism, chords that lead on for a long time and go to unrelated keys. I'm just going to play Big Eater now, and we can talk a little bit about the band after that. So we're talking a little bit about the Bad Plus. I gave you my thoughts on it, and I just wondered, how did the band come about, and what do you think maybe was the key to your success?
Well, someone I really admire once told me, the secret to a career of longevity in the arts requires three things. You need to have talent, you need to work hard, and you need luck. And you can go pretty far on two of the three, but, you know, to go all the way, you need all three in the play. And certainly luck was a factor. The three of us knew each other sort of going way back. We're all from the Midwest. Reed and Dave played together when they were in high school, and I met them when I was very young, too. And, you know, originally it was a place for the three of us to play ourselves and bring to the table whatever we loved. In the case of Big Eater, I think there's moments that could sound like minimalism, that could sound like Steve Reich, maybe. There are things that come from Latin music. Dave's intro is kind of like a version of of that sort of, I don't know, Afro-Cuban or something. Some of the harmonies are more straight than in normal jazz. When you talk about tonalities going over the map, I think you're also really responding to that the tonalities are pretty quite simple. So you can hear they're going far away. In a thicker harmonic palette, if it's Bill Evans or Herbie Hancock, you can't always tell if you're going further away or not because it's all rich harmony. But in My Harmony and the Bad Plus, it's primary colors. You can really like, oh boy, that chord doesn't go there. Yes, I double down on it and insist it does not go there.
And play it again just to make sure everyone knows that you definitely meant that one. Yeah. I love it. I mean, for some ways, it's what I talk about, the music of Thelonious Monk. I think there's humor in his music, and I think that was one of the things that, for me, if I was to say, I mean, there's many great things about him, but that thing of bringing out the humour. You mentioned Django Bates. He's very good at doing that. And also think the Bad Plus were like that. I mean, I had friends who'd come around for an evening and play it. They weren't jazz, you know, fans or anything. And they would see the humour in it, you know, and we would actually be giggling a little bit, you know, but enjoying the music as well.
For sure, Monk is one of my biggest influences. And there's a kind of complex emotion that will involve humour and irony and deadly serious at all at the same time. We were never intending to be like clowning around, but, and certainly Monk never was intending to be clowning around, but I guess there is something, we're not too hip for jazz, you know what I mean? It's like sometimes jazz can be very internal
serious.
And very serious, you know, and kind of dour and for only for jazz fans. And that's not actually the jazz I really like. I like jazz that's outgoing and has some, you know, it has some pomp, it has some camp, it can have all these things in it that gives it a different kind of shine.
I'm going to play, if that's all right with you, 1972 medalist. And, yeah, well, the audience can listen out for the quirky melody, which is very attractive and very interesting. Talking a little bit about the Bad Plus, which was the group that you were one of the founding members of and was very successful. Given that it was so successful and popular, I wondered why you left this group, because that was quite a recent thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, I left at the top of the year. It was 17 years and we didn't get along anymore. So it was just like, I realized it was, no one's getting any younger. It was sort of like in a marriage, you probably need to decide at some point, are you just going to do the whole thing or are you going to divorce and just try to start again?
And I was thinking about asking you the question. I was thinking maybe as well that, you know, sometimes you do a band for a long time and it's great and everything, but as an artist, you want to do other things and not do just one thing. And sometimes you can do something to such an extent that, you know, everyone just knows you for that. And yet, actually, you might want to be playing with, you know, other musicians or doing a different type of music or anything. I mean, were those also considerations, do you think?
I am looking forward now, unencumbered by the Bad Plus, to really trying to flex my wings and do things that are really just my own and have maybe a kind of a different kind of scope. I just premiered a piano concerto, my first concerto with the American Composers Orchestra.
What was that called?
It's called Concerto to Scale. And
I looked it up, but I couldn't actually, I didn't manage to hear a version of that. So
it's not recorded yet, but it was just, we just played the premiere, and it's a significant work. And for me, for certainly, it's 18 minutes through composed for string orchestra, and we just did it at Zankel Hall, and it went really well, and there was a great review in the Times, and I'm hoping to do it more in the future. So that sort of feels good, like a fresh start in that. I'm back with my old boss, Mark Morris, who I was his music director for 5 years before being with the Bat Plus. And in May of last year, I was in Liverpool for a week playing the new suite Pepperland, which is kind of a look at the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper with original music by me and some arrangements of Beatles music, somewhat in the Bat Plus tradition, I would say. And it was a big hit. And because of that, we are actually going to do a 7-week UK tour next year. So you can look out for me there. I'll definitely be in England.
I will publicize the dates if I get them, because, that would be something I'd love to come and see. I mean, you talked a little bit about Django Bates. I'm just going to mention him again because I've not got the greatest memory, but I seem to recall maybe a year ago he did a tribute to the Beatles as well. Sergeant
Absolutely.
Pepper. Yeah.
I think that was one of the signal events in his life was that album. And there were tributes because it was 50 years of the album.
Yeah.
So there were tributes all over. And yes, we were both involved in one.
Oh, okay. Cool. I think I'll move on to this particular question now, because we've been talking about Django. So you've got a blog,
Do the Math,
and with the A as an at, and I had a brief look at this. I mean, I literally, it was a brief look, so I apologize that I didn't have time to look at loads. But what I noticed, as well as your thoughts, you also list influences on you as a musician at one point. And I noticed that you named some English names. So we talked about Django, and you said, you mentioned quite a few times, which incidentally he was very influential. Well, still is influential, but when I was growing up, he was just a few years older than me, and I used to check out his band a lot. Yeah, he was very, very important in my development. So I kind of share that admiration. You also mentioned Martin France and Steve Arguelles. I mean, I'm sure there are other people on the blog, but that's kind of what caught my attention. And I just wondered what it is about them, maybe, that you like, admire. Is there something about an Englishness about the music, or is it just coincidental they happen to be from the UK?
I mean, certainly there's got to be an Englishness about them, for sure. I mean, I think it's important to sound like where you're from, actually. You don't get to change that. Wherever you're born, whoever you are, that's who you are. And you need to accept that as an artist. I guess I think if you play jazz, that's one of the opportunities, is to, you know, let your inner self, that ancient self of whoever you are, you know, let it out, even when playing the blues or whatever you're doing as a jazz player. So I don't know if I can tell you exactly why, you know, Martin France sounds like an English drummer or something like that. I don't know if it can be, everything can be broken down that way. But that group Martin France was in with Django Bates, with Montessori on bass and Bellamy on saxophone, that was a great group, Human Chain, and they've made several records for JMT, which are really kind of classic records in my mind. Steve Arguelles, that's almost like a Martin Speak connection, because we all met at Banff in 1990, and I responded to Martin Speak, and it's great to still be here with Martin and building that relationship. And Steve, who I have not seen in years, really made an impact on me at Banff, because he was sort of a really artistic person who had there's a lot of African sounds coming out of his drums, and I think that was because of this person, Dudu Pukwana, who I don't know his music that well, but I know that Steve worked with him, and whatever, this kind of South African sound was in his drumming that was really beautiful. And it, again, just starts to show you can sort of do anything you want in jazz, if you know, as long as you're personal and it's honest, I guess.
I'm just take those three musicians, for instance. I mean, I would say that the thing that oozes from them is personality in their music. Django, he can create humor, he's got excellent compositions, very creative musician, a fantastic improviser, and you can see how he's taken on the jazz tradition, but he's managed to make it his own. And there's a certain maybe quirkiness that you get from English musicians. I don't know, maybe that's typical of other places, but I think that sort of slight sense of humour as well is, you know, you talk about Ian Bellamy. I mean, you know, they're I think they see the fun in music as well as the seriousness.
Well, it's not slight humour when you talk about Django Bates.
Okay.
It's a laugh riot. You know, the version of New York, New York is hysterical.
Yeah.
And I love this interval song where you teach the kids, you know, But it's honest from Django. I think it might be annoying coming from someone where that wasn't an honest place, but for him, it's very honest.
And I talk about the strong personalities. I mean, I heard this story, and I wouldn't say that I know whether it's right or wrong, but I heard a story that Steve Arguelles was the Ronnie Scott's drummer, and that he was playing with Ronnie Scott, and he was, you know, great swing drummer, and then one night he decided not to put the hi-hat on 2 and 4, put it on 1 and 3, maybe for whatever reason, maybe as an artistic statement, and I was told that that was the last thing. Now this could be completely made up, but what I'm feeling is knowing someone like Steve, who's such an individual drummer, that his thoughts on music, you know, he might have done something like that, whether it's true or not.
Well, we could talk about where the hi-hat goes all day. I mean, I have a lot of opinions about that. I mean, you shouldn't, I do think probably anyone who's really serious about playing jazz battles, you know, tradition versus innovation in each in their own way. And I actually think they're equally important, you know. I'm lucky to be associated with Billy Hart, the drummer who, you know, he is a consecrated jazz master. Everything he plays is authentic. And that's really had an impact on my playing. I've been able to play with some other people like Ron Carter and Charlie Hayden, Tootie Heath, Paul Motion, and, you know, they're all idiosyncratic, but they all are also incredibly traditional. And I really respect that, too. And going forward now as a educator a little bit, as I'm here at Trinity de la Bonne today, or what I'm playing, you know, even the way I'm going to play with Martin Speak tonight at Pizza Express, I think I'm wanting to make sure that the traditional side is as represented as the creative side.
Said a little bit about your being at Trinity Laban taking a masterclass, and I just wanted to perhaps pick up on that point. So I just wondered, if is jazz education something you're involved in, and do you see it as an important part of education, musical education?
I don't know. I think there's big problems with jazz education. I mean, there's something really incorrect about a lot of it. I'm sort of confounded. I'm in it because I've spoken so strongly against it for so many years, but I guess I think this is where we are, and people learn about the music in the schools as much as they learn about it anywhere else. It's never on the radio. It's never has almost no presence in the popular culture in America or probably anywhere else. The young people that are interested in jazz are often students, and so I've decided to, yes, throw my hat in the ring and be part of the choir of people yelling at young people about what the heck jazz is. For better or for worse.
Well, I suppose anything that publicizes our kind of music, you know, even if those people don't end up being jazz musicians, they'll either appreciate it and then hopefully pass that appreciation onto their families and their friends, or maybe decide to run a jazz club or something.
Well, I think jazz really does require thinking on your feet. And that's one thing the European classical tradition doesn't have. You can't really be spontaneous. I mean, of course, if you're playing Baroque music with traditional instruments, you can make your ornaments and you can do things. But generally, you aren't that spontaneous. And that part, I think, is good to teach anybody, to just be in the moment and play and just react to what someone else is doing and have some flexibility. That part of jazz education, I think, is good for anybody no matter what they're going to do.
To
teach some kind of flexibility and living in the moment.
There are things that you can learn from being creative and spontaneous that can apply not just to music, but other areas of life.
Thank you.
come to my final question now, and I think you were kind of talking a bit about it, about your orchestral piece, but maybe in a broader sense, other things. Do you have any future plans, anything artistic, anything that you haven't yet achieved, which you think, you know, given the right circumstances, even fantasy, you know, what's coming up?
Somehow this year is already quite busy. In fact, I could hardly take any more work on between now and the end of the year. After I'm done with Martin's tour, I'm playing at the Moors Festival in Germany with Josephine Bode and Dodo Kiss, two recorder players. That's going to be some improvised music. After that, I'm at the Vanguard in New York playing serious jazz with Billy Hart's quartet, but Chris Potter as a guest soloist. In June, I'm accompanying Judith Berkson, a great singer in New York, and songs of Schoenberg and Ives. In July, there's a big tour, the Billy Hart Quartet featuring Joshua Redman. That's a 3-week major tour. And in the fall, ECM is putting out a duo record of me and Mark Turner, and we're going to be on tour both in Europe and America. In November, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this yet, the deal isn't signed, but I expect to be a presence at the London Jazz Festival, perhaps even in a kind of curatorial role talking about English jazz, actually.
Okay.
And at the end of the year, I'll be at the Umbria Jazz Festival with a Bud Powell project with Ingrid Jensen and Dana Stevens, Ben Street and Lewis Nash as the core quintet, but also for big band arrangements, a 75-minute suite of Bud Powell. So
wow.
That's the year.
Wow. Well, I asked. I think that's fantastic. Everything seems to be interesting. You're doing some stuff that's probably written, some that's improvised,
right.
And, you know, in different countries. What more could a musician want?
Nothing, really. It's looking remarkably positive. Because I was nervous quitting the band and, like, losing the steady job and all that sort of stuff. But so far, knock on wood, it's all working out.
Great. Well, thank you so much for giving up some of your time today, and look forward to seeing you when you come back with that project.
Great.
Okay,
thanks.